let's throw it open to the floor. Would anybody like to put any points?
Are emails bugged? And if they were, how would you know?
Yeah, looks like it's you, Ross, I think.
Emails that people send you may have bugs in them. For example, small images with unique URLs, such that if you load that particular email into an HTML-capable viewer, then that image will be fetched, telling the sender that the email has been read. And then, of course, there's the stuff that the government gets up to. With the Interception Modernization Program, proposing to compel the larger ISPs and communication service providers to keep some kinds of traffic data for extended periods of time that may contain details of who sent emails to whom and when. It may even contain bodies of emails themselves. We are told that there will be more details published in December. It's unclear how full the published material will be as a description of what's really proposed.
Yeah, if a database is deemed to be illegal, who ensures that the data on that database is actually eradicated, and how do you do it?
And if the data is held unlawfully, then we have enforcement powers as the Information Commissioner to require that data to be removed. I mean, there is actually an interesting question, which I mean, the panel, and again, maybe it's for Ross, about deletion of data, because some of the databases that you talked about in the database state report that are being wound up. I think you actually use the words pull the plug and throw it on the skip. I'm sure that's not quite what you meant. But, I mean, there is actually a challenge, I think, about dismantling some of these data, particularly when they're audit trails and all sorts of information that sits behind them, actually removing the data and destroying it. Is that a real problem or a myth?
It can be a real problem if it's not feasible to simply physically destroy all the equipment. But what may be the case, and what I understand is the case with some systems, such as the National Identity Register, is they don't propose to throw away all the data. The data are scattered around the Department of Work and Pensions, customer information systems, for example, the so-called Identity and Passport Service, and although there may be some token act of something being turned off, it can be very, very hard indeed for an outsider to find out exactly what was deleted by whom and how you can be sure that nobody kept a copy, just to be on the safe side, just in case the next government changes its mind.
There's also a legal point in that issue, in that the law makes it very clear. If you have deleted information in a way in which it can be recovered, it was never deleted in the first place. So when you expunge it, if you look at the difference in for example, the data protection laws we have in the UK and in Ireland, and the wording in Germany, for example, there the word expunge is used to mean absolutely, utterly, and totally obliterated, so it cannot be recovered. Simply changing an encryption key, password, or leaving an encryption key, or deleting an encryption key in the UK, which is often allowed, is not actually technically in line with the way the data protection directives were drafted. If it can be recovered in any way, shape, or form, that data has not been destroyed. Now, there are technical ways in which you first of all can wipe the disk, and then you physically destroy the disk. But again, it goes down to cost-benefit, and what people are prepared to pay.
Yeah, good point. Sorry, Angela, you.
I worry that it will be increasingly difficult to actually enforce the deletion and destruction of that data for one reason, that given the current economic climate and the current financial situation we are in, there seems to be at least some people holding the idea that widespread data sharing is a way of getting economies of scale, and that's basically by just sharing citizens' data pretty liberally between many departments, you could save the government lots of money in operation. And that particular paradigm, I think, means that you might have a really difficult job trying to pinpoint where the data actually is and where it's gone to. So you might be able to delete it at the origin, but not in other places. And an additional thing is that I've observed that certainly the government, another way of saving lots of money is by moving as far as possible all interaction between the citizen and the government to online services. So that's one thing the government like to do, but it's also very clear that it desperately does not want to be the identity provider, and that it very desperately would like commercial private enterprises to become the identity provider. And I think that raises some very interesting question, and I've certainly seen some of the organizations that hold lots of information about individuals cozying up to government and saying that really data sharing between government and industry would really be a good thing, and some of that's already going on. So it may be, I think, in future, really quite futile trying to destroy anything, because there will be so many shared copies of it out there.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely right. Data sharing is very much sort of on the political agenda. I mean, it has been, and not just this government, not just the coalition government, the previous government, seen as an answer
answer to lots, you know, to I mean, it's almost like, it's almost touching, you know, how you know, it becomes this totemic status of being the answer to our problem.
And what's particularly being presented now, you're right, is the sharing between private sector and public sector, and particularly sort of things like credit information.
We're being encouraged to submit our personal data to all sorts of online services without any assurance of security. Would a global security policy that all services subscribe to be feasible?
You can't realistically have a single security policy, because in some applications you're trying to stop information flowing down, in others you're trying to stop it flowing up, and in others you're trying to stop it flowing sideways. On the globalization front, there are people who argue from time to time that global enforcement would be useful. And there's a sense in which the European Union is becoming the world's privacy regulator, because America doesn't care and no other country is big enough to matter. As for world government, though, I think there are strong policy objections to that. However, the global public goods thing is an important insight, and the insecurity of the internet is like protecting the environment or providing enough scientific research. It's a global public good that will be underprovided. Suppose, for example, you're the commissioner of the Met, right? And a bad guy in St. Petersburg sends out 1 million phishing emails tomorrow morning. Now, London's about 1% of the internet, so 10,000 of these arrive in your manor. Do you devote time, effort, and money to extraditing this little idiot from his flat in St. Petersburg and putting him on trial? Of course not. You say, hey, the FBI will have had 200,000 of these. Let them do the heavy lifting. Right? So to a first approximation, the Met and other police forces just don't care about cybercrime, because the incentives are wrong for them to tackle globalized petty crime. The FBI is trying to do some things, but not anything like enough. In theory, you could fix this with world government, but it's not going to happen. So internet insecurity, like pollution of the environment, or like inadequate spending on scientific research, is something that's likely to be around for a long, long time.
Global enforcement is very attractive in theory. In practice, it's an absolute nightmare.
Plenty of work for the lawyers, though.
Oh, God, no, you do not want to get them started there, believe you me. It might actually be worth having a commission full of lawyers there. You wouldn't have lawyers elsewhere. But in reality, it is very dangerous. It's very attractive when we are here and someone has done something in, say, St. Petersburg, which we object to. We can say, you swines, we want to get you. It's very different when the boot's on the other foot and you've done something quite innocently and a third party wants to extradite you because they have taken offence at it. In terms of the other aspect we've got to think of is the fact that technology is racing way ahead of legal understanding in one sense, but also way ahead of the law in the other sense, but in a very bad sense. A lot of technologists are proud of their ignorance of the law. They think that the law is there to stop them, because the lawyers tend to go around saying, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this at all, you can't do anything at all. They want to do things. And so quite rationally, they want to go and develop new technologies, new services. Cloud computing is one of them. Unfortunately, according to the law, and these principles have been based for 2,000-3,000 years, if you follow them, cloud computing is illegal. Who knew that? You are breaking the criminal law in most jurisdictions if you use it, unless you know where that data is being stored. And it has got nothing to do with personal data. There are other records that governments care very greatly about, and those records are not allowed to be moved outside of their jurisdiction without their permission. Personal data is not one of those records. Yes, personal data is an issue. You've got to make sure you've secured it. But there are other record types. And most people are blissfully unaware of this. Now, that's one thing we have to look at. We're not just, as we said, in corporate privacy. We're not just thinking about personal data. We're thinking about the entire record type. How do you safeguard them? There's another aspect. And it's a lovely little regulation that catches you unawares. And it's Section 450 of the Companies Act, 1985. Now, I mentioned this to some people a couple of years back, and a very senior barrister, because of course you realize, Mr. Davies, that the Companies Act 2006 has replaced it. Yes, I said, but have you read Section 1124? No. Okay. If you read that section, it actually strengthens Section 450 of the Companies Act 1985. It's still there. And what this little thing says is if you are in management or an officer of the company, or you're deemed to be such, and you are party to the destruction, mutilation, or falsification, or have allowed it to occur, then unless you can prove that you didn't intend to hide the internal affairs of the company, you are liable to up to 7 years in jail and or an unlimited fine. Now, there's a recipe for information security if ever there was one. Where are your records? Do you know where they are? Have you protected them? Why were they destroyed in the first place? Now, that still stands, and that section goes back a long, long, long way. The 85 Act was only a rewrite of that section. It covers any information in any form. We're not just talking about certain information types. It could even encompass the pages of a paper diary, as a one Ernest Saunders discovered to his cost. Three pages. The courts have described that particular section as the heavy artillery of the company's law, because it forces you to know and understand where your records are. Unfortunately, you will hardly find that section talked in any company law case book. Why? Because it's black and white. You can't debate about it. You can't sit and have moots over it. It is not interesting to a law lecturer. It's damned interesting if you're held to it. So you've got to understand where they are. So when you're looking at the technical advances, yes, you have the technology. Are those technologies suitable for the job? We mentioned tort law earlier on. There are very old principles where if you select a technology which is not suitable for your purposes and you use it knowingly, you are liable. But at the same time, if you fail to select new technology which could help you do your job in a better way and don't use them, you can also be held liable. It's tough being a corporate person. Which way do you go? Lawyers love it.
Angela, do you want to? I mean, I would just pick up the point about, you know, increasing globalisation. Whether we move towards detailed global standards, I think it is unlikely, but there's a strong move to see general standards of handling personal information, you know, the requirements for, as we said, adequate security, but the other aspects as well, that individuals have a say, a control, a right of access to their data, and so on, becoming international standards. And it's a move that we and other data protection authorities are promoting. You know, we're some way off, but you can perhaps see parallels with areas like the shipping industry, the airlines, aircraft, where these are global industries, they're global flows, and there is, you know, international regulation of shipping and airlines and so on. And clearly, you know, these days, information flows and the use of personal information is very much an international matter. It crosses all the boundaries. So the case for having some sort of similar form of international regulation grows stronger and stronger all the time. It's getting anybody to, you know, sort of bite the bullet and take that responsibility, and governments to agree on this, which is the real challenge.
Professor Angela Sassi touched on the point that we have to remember quite a number of pins nowadays. Do we automatically forfeit our right for compensation in the case of fraud if we do write them down?
Or maybe the lawyers would like.
It's basically you've signed. You know, when you sign the contract for your bank account, you basically agree to these conditions. Maybe people should, you know, maybe we should ask for to start looking for a bank that takes a more reasonable, you know, takes a more reasonable view of that. But at the moment, they all do the same thing. I think it certainly is an unfair condition for some customers. For instance, if you you know, if you are occasionally housebound and you can't go out, you know, and get your cash in your supplies, and you need to give it to somebody else because otherwise you can't manage. I certainly think there should be an obligation to provide an adequate arrangement where you can delegate powers mm-hmm. without breaking the conditions of use for the account.
Yeah. We heard the word fair. Ears and eyes sparkle and prick up when we hear the word fair. Define fair. You're a customer of a bank, and your interest rates have been dropped on your savings. The money you can get back on investments have been cut. Dividends perhaps have been cut because you're having to pay for someone who decided to hand their PIN to someone else and they managed to clear out half the accounts. Now, is it fair that they are held personally responsible? To your perspective, it is. You don't want to pay for someone else's mistake. The second thing about the law is not at all about what is fair. Okay? Get rid of that idea. We used to get students coming up with little starry-eyed saying, we want to know about how to wheel oil the wheels of society. We want to know about fairness, justice. Forget about it. Okay? Law isn't about that. The law is about trying to find certainty. Finding a set of rules that the vast majority can live by, there will always be some who complain, tough. It's society. It's a cost. There's some rules I don't like, but I've got to follow them. That's the way it is. But at the same time, people do try to look at what is right and what is not. If you are housebound and you have to sign your PIN over, the banks will very rarely, if you've honestly given it to someone on whose you could depend or you should have been able to trust, they owed you a fiduciary duty, let us say it's a helper, someone who is employed to look after you, and they go off to Barbados for a holiday instead of picking up your prescription, then the bank won't go for you, they'll go for them. But if you've given your PIN to a stranger in the street without having any reason whatsoever to rely on them, be able to trust them, whatever, that's your problem. Because again, you are expected as free individuals, we're in a free society after all, to at least have some common sense. Now, I know common sense is not very common. And most people who claim to have it don't have much sense. But the problem is that you have to make a decision. You have to bear responsibility. The alternative is to try and find a nanny state where you're told exactly what you can do at every point in time. You don't have freedom. If you have freedom, you will have risks. How many of you, for example, skydive? How many? Okay. Do you know it's actually one of the safest hobbies you can do statistically? It is safer to skydive than it is to get into a shower. You will fall out of a shower and break your neck. You're far more likely to have that occur than you are to die skydiving. The problem is that the damage that occurs if your parachute doesn't open, one is fairly determined, and also it's fairly messy, and it makes the press. How many reports do you see in the newspaper of someone who slipped when they were getting dressed? Or someone who slipped having a shower? Or fell down the stairs? People don't know how to look at risk. They don't understand probability. Something which might be perceived as being very risky may actually not be that risky at all. It's just it looks frightening. Something which looks perfectly natural may actually be very, very risky, but we don't understand how to apportion it.
If you look at the third annex to the British Crime Survey, which came out, I think, in June or July, this is a standard way of trying to figure out how much crime there is. Trying to figure it out by looking at police reports is a waste of time because there are too many strange incentives on the police and too many interferences by government to massage the figures downwards. So the robust way of finding out who suffers what is to go out and get 44,000 people once a year and ask them, have you been a victim of crime last year? What the survey found in its most recent incarnation is that there were, roughly speaking, 1 million traditional acquisitive crimes in Britain last year, burglaries, thefts of and from vehicles, and so on. And there were about slightly more than 2 million, crimes of a more modern type. Credit card disputes, phishing attacks on people's bank accounts, dodgy auctions, things like that. Now, we don't have enough granularity to know for sure, but it seems a good bet that most of these are, in some sense, online crimes. So we've got to the point that online villainy is now most of it. And while traditional crime is falling, online crime is growing rapidly. It may still be the case that traditional crime has more impact on victims. It's more unpleasant to come home and find that your house has been trashed by a burglar than it is to have to argue with the bank over a couple of ATM withdrawals that you didn't make. But nonetheless, the online crime is catching up. The amount of effort that the police put into online crime is essentially zero. And if things continue, there's ultimately a question about the social contract. Because after all, what governments are is an agreement between us and them of obedience in return for protection. And if they're no longer able or willing to provide protection against the bad things that most vex and irritate people, then what's the point in having the government in London? Perhaps we should abolish Britain and just have the European government, or perhaps we should bring things down to a local level or whatever. It does pose some hard strategic choices for the chaps and chapesses in Westminster.
Can I just put a variation on that question? I suppose this is mainly for you, Ross, but the others may want to answer. The question was about, if you write your PIN down. What if you don't write your PIN down, but the bank says your card was used, and you say, honestly, my card wasn't used, and the bank says, look, chip and PIN is faultless, it's clear your card was used, you must have given your card to someone else, you must have written it down, sort of, it must be your fault.
Well, this is exactly what the banks do. And I'm afraid that if you are someone, I was contacted just a couple of days ago by the daughter-in-law of a man aged 85 who had two phantom withdrawals on his bank account, then the bank will, in every single case, say that it was your fault, your PIN was used, your card was used, and that is the end of the matter. They won't enter into any correspondence. They will suggest that you talk to the Financial Ombudsman Service. The Financial Ombudsman will automatically decide in favor of the bank, regardless of the law and the evidence. And there is nothing you can do then, unless you have got several hundred thousand pounds, to brief serious lawyers, not the kind that you get in a county town high street, but the kind you get in very expensive chambers in London, and what's more, to take on the chin the bill for the bank's costs if you lose. So in that situation, you are completely defenseless. You have lost your money, the bank has taken your money off you, and they will laugh. End of story. And that is a regulatory failure, and it goes back to the fact that the first time a little old lady sued a bank for her money back in America in 1976, Dorothy Judd won against Citibank, and as a result, America's Regulation E says that the onus of proof is on the bank. In Britain, John and Jean McConville and others sued Barclays Bank and others in 1992. Barclays, with 12 other defendant banks, defeated their case. It turned out later that this was wrong. The judge simply got it wrong. But nonetheless, that has entrenched in the British way of doing things the opinion that the bank is always right. There have been attempts at Europe by means of the Payment Services Directive of 2007 to fix this. According to directors of the European Central Bank that I spoke to, their attempts to do this were frustrated by lobbying from the Treasury and from the British financial services industry led by Barclays. That was such a bruising experience that the Eurocrats don't have the stomach for another go around the circuit. So if you want to do online or electronic banking and have reasonable consumer protection, then the only advice I can give to you is open an account in another jurisdiction, preferably America, although Ireland, Holland might also do us a pinch.
Do you want to add a legal perspective to that?
No, you're right. Unfortunately, it is a regulatory failure. because the regulators, I'm not going to mince my words here, were too spineless to actually follow what the law actually said. The second problem is that the English system of law doesn't give you an automatic right to appeal, as continental systems tend to do. So if you lose, you have to appeal. You pay the first cost, you put them up to court, and then you have to appeal, and appealing is incredibly expensive. We also have a system where a lot of judges will follow precedent, even if the precedent they're following is wrong, because they do not want to change law. Judges are often accused of wanting to make the law. They don't. That is the job for Parliament. Where there are gaps, they will, if they really, really, really have to, come up with new precedent. Now, lawyers often talk about precedent. It's actually a comfort blanket for them. So they can follow exactly what was done in the past. They don't like change. A lot of lawyers hate computers. They'd rather go back to vellum and quill pen. You may think it's antediluvian because they don't want to type. No, it's because they can detect changes on vellum. You can detect changes on paper. It's very, very hard, and word processors have made going through contracts an absolute nightmare, because lawyers have often tried to change boilerplate without telling the other side. And so you have to go through every single line. So lawyers don't like it either. They don't like change. The third problem is chip and pin is based on a fallacy that it's secure. It's not secure. The design is flawed. EMV does not make systems secure. But the banks have used it, and the chip and pin model has been a perfect example of where the industry has taken the liability from themselves and pushed it straight out to their clients. Now, the law actually does state, and if it gets into full appeal, the consumer would win. But it's the cost. But the banks would have to prove that you acted in an unreasonable way, that you acted in a way in which you did abuse the system, or otherwise it is their fault because they have provided a service, they have contracted with you, and therefore they should bear the liability of having selected that service in the first place. Now, there is case law on this in England and Wales, whereby if you force someone to use something and it goes wrong, you have to prove that technology was up to scratch, not that they made an error. Well, they've got to prove that they didn't make an error. So we sometimes have weak cases, weak judges who may not actually understand the subject matter, who may make a mistake, and then the system doesn't immediately correct it, but is terrified of doing so. And it will cost money. Now, there are moves, as Professor Anderson says correctly, to try to change that. And indeed, there have been moves to try and change it in the UK as well. The banking industry doesn't want it. They have invested in EMV. They have invested in chip and pin. They do not want to admit they made a mistake. Now, maybe the regulators will wake up to this. Maybe they will finally change it. But that is what it will take. Either that or someone with incredibly deep pockets or lawyers who are incredibly generous. And when you're in a very big firm, which is very expensive to run because you have overheads of a 24/7 operation, you don't often have time to be generous. Now, they are. They will run, for example, death row appeals free of charge, each of which costs over $500,000 to run. But there's a limit to what they themselves can afford to do.
Or is there perhaps a prospect that someone will be able to show, have evidence, witnesses, that they were there in a place with their card in their possession at the time when the bank says... I mean, I just think there was an example in a different area, the use of DNA, where the police had a DNA sample from a crime scene and it matched on their database, and they went to arrest someone. And, DNA is infallible, it has to match, it's... And the crime was, I think it was a burglary, where someone had climbed in through an upstairs window. And when they went to arrest this person, they were essentially disabled and in a wheelchair. And, it couldn't have been them. And the police accepted that, the match was... Do they call it an adventitious match? It was the one in a million or whatever chances. And after that, the number of points that they used for comparison was, I think, doubled. The system was changed as a result of that.
Unfortunately, a lot of the claims where people go and say, I've had money taken out of my account, are actually where they've given their PIN to someone and that person's run off, the child, or they've given it to their girlfriend, have gone out with their boyfriend to go off and buy in sales. That happens a lot. And so they are hardened. But if you can prove, I had my card, I was actually in Hong Kong, and this withdrawal took place in London. You knew I was in Hong Kong because I was in your actual offices applying for another facility. So how could I have withdrawn money in London? Then they will look at it, but they will keep those settlements quite quiet because it's in their interests to fight every single case. It's the same with insurance claims. You sometimes wonder, why do insurers fight negligible claims? They fight it to show they will defend against spurious claims. If you have a genuine claim, usually they will settle. If you can prove to a bank that indeed you couldn't have given out your PIN, it couldn't have been you. It happened to us recently. I got phoned up and said, we asked why we had this withdrawal in this credit account. And eventually we discovered that the credit cards had been cloned. And they were being used quite happily in India and Pakistan. We were never there. Luckily, we could show that. Why? We had flight tickets. We weren't in Pakistan, we were in the States. There's no way the card could have been used in two places. At that point, you can provide proof. But simply saying he says, she says, they will rely on the spurious notion that chip and PIN is secure. You've got to provide evidence. And evidence doesn't mean something which might have occurred. Evidence has to be solid. If you've got that, you might be safe.
It's right when Ross correct, basically pointed out that the situation in the US is different. And I think, ironically, what you find there, it's led to adding some technology at the cash point, which I think would help here as well, because there, basically, every time you make a cash withdrawal, the photograph is taken of the person that makes the withdrawal. And if they provided the same technology here, which there was basically the banks have essentially there introduced to protect themselves, to basically be able to prove these cases where people claim it. But it also helps, of course, the honest customers to prove. And, to me, it actually, I don't understand why we don't have that. Yeah.
Although I suppose you might argue that's another intrusion into your privacy. It's more surveillance if your photograph's taken every time you use your...
Really? Is it?
I'm basically wondering, I'll put it to the panel, how much better apparently European privacy law is than the UK, potentially with the situation where the Europeans aren't at all happy with the UK with the handling of the BT form situation, albeit that was breaking of the Ripper Act, I believe, rather than data protection directly. Comments and as regards to will the UK be sort of trying to come up to European spec pretty quickly before we start getting fined rather excessively in the near future?
I think when we go to, when we go to conferences with colleagues in continental Europe, they ask us why people aren't rioting in the UK. They can't understand why we put up with the, the relatively weak data protection that we have in the UK.
I'll put you on the spot. Do you think that's right? Or do you think we're different? Or do you think it's just our laws different?
I sometimes wonder, I'm not a lawyer, but I sometimes wonder whether the legal situation has something to do with it. Because I remember, basically the German, German politician are just as tempted to grab certain powers and certain laws as politicians elsewhere are, It's not that they are sort of like saints. And so we had the a few years ago there was the case that the Home Secretary there wanted to install spyware on every citizen's PC, so that if basically something was amiss, they could basically figure out where it came from and had been done. And they basically managed to hammer that law through through the Parliament. But then several local data protection registrars basically went to the Constitutional Court. And it became clear very quickly that this law couldn't be reconciled with the German Constitution. I think one of the issues is that here, that in the UK, you don't have the redress. It's not as easy to fight basically laws like that being pushed through because you don't have the Constitution. That's how I understand it. But please put me right.
This is another aspect of the problem referred to in the previous question, that in Britain it's next to impossible for middle-class people to sue because of the threat of paying the other side's costs if you lose. Now, in America, you don't have to pay the other side's costs at all, and in Germany, you only have to pay a small amount. I advised a lady in Germany, for example, who disputed the 20,000 euro series of ATM withdrawals, and although she lost in the first court, she only had to pay 2,000 euros in costs, so it was perfectly feasible for her to appeal. In Britain, you couldn't do that. Now, privacy is the same, right? Because there are all sorts of privacy rights we have, but are not enforced because the Information Commissioner isn't given the resources or the powers to do so, apparently. And we can't, as a practical matter, enforce these rights for ourselves, because who's going to go and spend 5 years of their life suing the Secretary of State for Health or the Home Secretary or whatever, and risk being saddled with a bill of £5 million in costs if you lose? Now, in America, it's the private enforcement of rights is perfectly feasible. Law professors go and do it all the time. They take issue with some particularly unpopular law. They take it to the Supreme Court. If they win, then they become famous and they can go and be elected as a senator or whatever. The incentives are all right. You know, they're all in place for people to go out and enforce their own rights. In Britain, we're absolutely at the other end of the spectrum, because the government has never really liked the idea that individuals should be able to enforce their own rights. And so we end up in a situation where, unless you've got legal aid, you've got legal aid, it's very, very difficult to do.
Why are we different? We've never been invaded. The United Kingdom has not been invaded. And if someone says William the Conqueror, that was England, not the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom came into fruition after the Acts of Union. We've never had a revolution. So as a result, we've never had to rewrite our laws from scratch. Now, if you go to the continent, virtually every territory has been invaded, smashed, rewritten, reformed, and renewed. And they have rewritten their laws from scratch. They've written new constitutions. They've written documents. They've had a philosophy of law. The Napoleonic Code, for example. And because of that, you can access your laws automatically. The United States is a slight aberration, or was an aberration in the common law jurisdictions, in that they actually wrote down a constitution. We do have a constitution, but it's not written down anywhere. If you ask someone, what are your rights in the UK, a lawyer would look at you as if you're mad. The reason is we don't have a prescriptive legal system. We have a proscriptive legal system. I can tell you what you can't do in terms of what you're prohibited doing by the criminal law. I can't tell you what your rights are because your rights are as a free man, theoretically. Now, the Magna Carta was written and signed through gritted teeth. And ever since then, the parliament, governments, monarchs have been trying to pull back and claw back powers. And they will do. Because in the UK, people are unaware of what their rights are. In the States, every child, theoretically at least, is taught about the Constitution and they know their rights. But the problem is they can take it to the nth degree and they get some insane judgments occasionally. Again, because there's this overinterpretation. Now, also on the continent, think about the abuse of governments. Think the First World War, the Second World War. There is a reason why governments after the Second World War decided to look at information privacy. Or rather, why the individuals who formed the constitutions decided to prevent governments from getting hold of the information. They never wanted the coalescence of economic power, political power, and knowledge and control of the individual to come together. And there was also a philosophical bent that was generated, which was that the information about you is yours, it's owned by you. If you want to take a slight aside, look at intellectual property law. We all talk about copyright glibly. In France, there's no such thing as copyright. You've got droit d'auteur, droit d'image, the right of the author. The right doesn't attach to the work, it attaches to you. So you have the right to withdraw an artwork if it no longer represents you, or you decide that you no longer want it shown. You can object to your image being used in a photograph because it doesn't represent you. That's your droit d'image. So there is a very well understood philosophy about the individual, the human being. In the UK, that is completely alien to us over here. Absolutely alien. We don't look at it. In fact, we blithely go through life being in pure ignorance of what we actually have in terms of our rights, our abilities, our freedoms. So when they're chipped away, we don't really fight about it. Now, the legal system does need reform. Every so often, the Lord Chancellor will finally decide, yes, enough's enough, we have to reform. It's too expensive. Even me, myself as a lawyer, I think the law is too expensive. Luckily, expensive lawyers can occasionally be generous. We can afford to be. And we do like doing so. But there are limits for everyone. But also, we set up a group of regulators who we thought, or we were hoping, would actually go out and enforce the regulation. Now, if you go back to Sun Tzu, or the biography, the point of regulator isn't to second-guess his political masters. The point of regulator is to produce a regulation and to enforce it, because no one else can do it. If they don't enforce, if they refuse to enforce, if they sit there and invent reasons not to enforce, they are not doing their job. Now, I've heard reasons why certain regulations aren't enforced, such as, oh, we have to specify every single record, which is rubbish, that's not what the law says, to, oh, people have a right to be tried in the magistrate's court rather than the Crown Court. Again, utter rubbish. The right's the other way. You can elect to push your case from the magistrates to the Crown Court. You cannot do it the other way. I've sat in rooms where I was talking to regulators and said, you actually have the right to levy an unlimited fine. All you've got to do is find the gumption to go to the Crown Court, to go for an indictment, not for summary judgment. You have the ability to be tough, but you don't want to be. And what they've forgotten, and this is very important, is they are the servants of the population. They are put in that role to make sure the system is followed. That's one of the reasons why, for example, the Scandinavians developed the Office of Ombudsman. It's a Scandinavian term. An individual who would sit there and who would act on behalf of the citizens to make sure that government or large organisations who the citizen couldn't possibly afford to take on could actually be protected against. That was their role. And they knew full well that when they took that role, there were certain commands they might not be able to follow, such as, oh, don't touch X or don't touch Y, because their role wasn't to follow every single order given to them by the person who appointed them. Their role was to act as the regulator, to act as the ombudsman, despite any criticism the parties appointed them would later levy on them. That is what they're being paid for.
And I think that put by our panellists in total is an excellent summary. I mean, I can't usefully add to it.
Very simple question, but it's very silly, that who owns the Facebook or Internet?
No, I think that's a perfectly reasonable, not a silly question at all. We'll come take that to our panel in a moment. There's one over.
Today, where Internet protocol technology is becoming pervasive and smart homes, smart buildings are becoming the norm, what is the view of the panel with the ability to integrate so many systems like heating and ventilation, security, closed-circuit TV, security systems, access control, and systems that are processing data? In other words, your maintenance man who's come to fix your heating has some method of getting at the data that he shouldn't necessarily get at.
In terms of the first question, who owns Facebook and or the Internet, define own. Define the word own. What do you mean by the word own? And that's actually a very serious question. Do you mean the technology behind Facebook? Do you mean the information? The problem is, it's very easy to ask a question like, such as, who owns? But the difficulty is defining what you mean by that question. Do you mean who owns Facebook, the company, the shareholders?
No.
Well, I can't, because in that case, I'm parting. What I'll say is, look at your definition. What do you think by owning means? If you say owning Facebook means owning the right, the intellectual property right, to the technology of Facebook, well, there's a dispute between two students at Harvard and the current CEO, if CEO won, settled out of court. If you're talking about Facebook as the company, who owns the company Facebook, well, it's the shareholders. That's simple. They own the company that has a technology which is called Facebook. If you're talking about who owns their page on Facebook, look at the terms and conditions. I don't use Facebook. I hope my genes will continue, but I don't use it. I don't like it. I see no reason to put my entire life's history online for someone else who I do not know to read. Okay, so I do not use it. Again, with the Internet, what do you mean by that? The Internet is this really wide, nebulous term. We use it as a term of art. Okay, it's separate networks joined to each other. Each network is owned by the operator in terms of the technology, the infrastructure they've put in. You're a user of the Internet. You use it as a user. You don't own it. Now, it might be that certain companies own patents to some of the technologies. Other companies have actually issued the technology free of charge to the world. In some jurisdictions, they would still own it, but they've issued it in the public domain. In a couple of jurisdictions, they have disowned in ownership. It is now out there. They no longer have any rights to it. So again, you have to think about that definition. In terms of what would happen if you're joining systems together and talk to each other, the first real answer is caveat emptor, buyer beware. Ask questions. Are the systems designed to be secure? Can you prevent the heating engineer discovering what your shopping habits are, for example? Where your bank account is? If not, don't put it in. Yes, it might look nice, but what's the cost? Don't covet thy neighbor's wife. The real meaning of it isn't a sexual meaning. It is a case of if you want something, understand all the costs that come with it. If you're willing to accept it, then fine. If you want to skydive, learn how to open that blasted parachute. Otherwise, it isn't for you, as you'll shortly discover. So you've got to understand what it can do. Yes?
That's a neat lawyer's answer. But in the complex minefield that is information technology, that is vast, it is clearly impossible for any individual, even an expert, to be able to be aware. So where businesses and companies are trying to sell their services, and there is this headlong rush to integrate, for a number of good reasons, the company I work for is promoting green technology and wanting to monitor buildings for green reasons and reduce energy use, etc. The ability of you, the owner of that business or building, be it an individual or a business, to monitor and make intelligent decisions about your energy use may be important. But if also at the same time on the same network in your property, you've also got your personal computers, your business computers, etc., then there's a whole raft of other interests all being pushed upon you, and they've all got complex issues that it's almost impossible for any one person to be able to answer the question. So caveat emptor is a neat lawyer's answer to a question that can't be answered anyway.
Caveat emptor is the only answer you can give, because you are adults. If you want to put it in and your house is beautifully automated, you've got all these systems, fine, then you have accepted that risk. If you didn't understand it but you went there, so be it. Now accept that if you want to do it and accept the risk, fine. Otherwise, the other lawyer's answer is, okay, have you made sure your systems are secure? So your systems can't tap it. If not, as a lawyer, I would go for you. If you want to sell a service, make sure that service is suitable. Do what you can. Because, yes, you may, the consumer may not know all the myriad of technologies being provided to him, but the providers certainly understand the technologies, or could do. So the onus then is shifted to the provider. In other words, caveat emptor. Can the provider give it to me? Buyer beware. It isn't just a trite saying, well, who knows? It's a case of, as a consumer, who would you go for? Would I go for and get a company supplying me that actually can tell me, yes, I have secured the system, and I will take liability. If it goes wrong, you may take me to the cleaners. Okay? That's the way you can handle it. The economic imperative is wonderful from the consumer point of view. The last question, junk mail and data mining, very trite answer by an email filter. The other one, of course, is it depends. The more deep answer is to work out what jurisdiction you're in the first place and where the junk mail is coming from. You may have an action in some cases. You may not. The point is, if you're using systems out there, you go onto an American website, let's say, type in your personal details, and it is not a company which has signed up to the Safe Harbor Principles, and it isn't a company which has said, we will keep our information secure, and you use a particular email address, and then you're getting junk mail addressed sent to that address, you may or may not be able to take action. How many of you go on to an online site and use a separate email address for each site to see where on earth these data miners are occurring? Exactly. You can track them. I know that one came from this database, that one came from that database, that one came from Russia, can't do anything about that. But those two in the States. One signed up to Safe Harbor, one didn't, can't do anything, I can do that. Okay? So again, there are tools you can take to protect yourself. A lot of the problem we have is that people sit there and say, I want something done, but I'm not going to do anything to help myself. If you want to live in a free society where you are free to decide what you can do and do it within the scope of the law, so for example, I've got the freedom to throw a brick at someone. If I hit them, or indeed if they see me throwing it at them, they can take action against me. That's my choice to throw that brick, and they can take action against me. It was my choice to break the law, and I should be punished for it. So similarly, it is my choice to sell this pen to someone or give it to someone. I can do it, but I can't take someone else's pen and give it to them instead. That's theft. But I can choose what course of action I take. If you want to live in that sort of society where you have that freedom, you will have to face risks. If you accept that, learn to judge the risks and learn to live with them and ameliorate them, mitigate them.
Let's turn to Ross. Your points on the questions and final remarks, Ross.
Well, systems engineering has for many years been about rolling a rock up the complexity mountain and seeing how high you get before you fall off. Now, as we get better and better tools, we're able to roll the rock higher and higher up the mountain. But still, there are limits. Some of these limits are set by the computer science, others by organizational complexity, by microeconomics, if you like, and others by our own ability cognitively to handle complexity. That's the psychology aspect of it. Now, these are, if you like, the three pillars of the security engineering, privacy engineering, dependability engineering profession: the computer science, the economics, and the psychology. And these apply to domestic systems as to anything else. If you let the complexity get out of control, then your ability to manage these systems will also obviously go out of control.
Thanks very much. Angela?
I think, you know, basically, or I know from my own work that, you know, I think there's limits to being able to do caveat emptor, you know, because you simply don't, there's only so many hours in the day. And for each, you know, individual consumer to go through each of these terms and, you know, conditions and try and figure it out is unrealistic. So I think incredibly what we probably need something increasingly like unionizing of consumers to basically form there to fight back and basically say, look, here is what we want. And whatever business is willing to basically give us those protections, those are, you know, the ones we will engage with. There's been at the last conference on computers, privacy and freedom, a group of people got together and put forward a charter for a bill of rights for social networking users. And their idea is that they currently, they put this out for discussion and draft, but their idea is that they will put this to those various providers and say, will you sign up to this? If not, you know, it will be quite clear to anyone out there that you don't, you know, that you're not willing to protect these 15 rights that we think anybody who puts their data on a social network so will. And then we'll see whether people are actually really going to vote with their feet and go for the safe ones.
Thanks. Well, thanks very much to you all. It falls to me now to sum up the evening, an almost impossible task, I think, other than to say it's been an absolutely fascinating, enlightening, and I think to some extent entertaining discussion as well. So thank you very much for that. I mean, I suppose we start in many ways where Ross started. I mean, this is a real and a complex problem, getting security and privacy right. And with the growth, particularly of online activities, we've had to talk about Facebook, becoming more and more challenging all the time. If it was just down to the technology and computer science, yes, maybe it would be more straightforward, but it's not. It's not just about technology, although that's very important. It's about people and it's about the psychology. And we all behave irrationally from time to time. We don't think the same way as our, you know, our German colleagues and neighbours or whatever. And it's down to economics as well and the economics of businesses. And businesses are driven differently. Some are very much driven by the economic value of trust and confidence of their customers. And some are driven by, you know, the opportunity just to make a quick buck as quickly as possible and close down and don't have that sense of responsibility. So it is complex and difficult. What I do think it, you know, came out and is important is that we can't transfer, you know, the responsibility for security and privacy too much to the individual. You know, all of us have to take some care over our information. But it's like the chip and pin thing. You know, at the end of the day, this is the bank's problem, not our problem. And those organisations that look after our information do have to treat it responsibly, securely. And if they don't, you know, there is an element of voting with your feet, taking your business elsewhere. Don't let them transfer the onus on to you. But in businesses taking responsibility, you know, all our speakers have talked about risk. There is an element about we do have to accept that there's some risk there. There are no absolute security solutions. You look at the risk, you take appropriate measures, and then that That is the requirement, the regulatory requirement. It doesn't mean that data will never be lost or there'll never be a problem. And we have to resist, I suppose, being overly critical and jumping on the bandwagon of some of the media hysteria about organisations, you know, that make one mistake when actually they've taken their risk analysis, you know, seriously and properly. And maybe this applies, you know, even more to the public sector organisations, state organisations, than it does to the private sector, which I think does come a lot on to, you know, very much the area that Ross was talking about state databases. A lot of these economic arguments, trust and confidence arguments, work very well with commercial businesses. But they're less effective with the state, where you have little choice but to give your information. So it is important that we move away from where, you know, the automatic reaction to any problem is we'll set up another database, we'll collect more information about people. That must be the answer. And I think actually there are some positive signs which we refer to, that, you know, we are being a little more critical about the use of databases to solve all our problems. And even when we do use databases, we don't have to collect so much information. I can't remember who it was now made the point, why do we have our names printed on the front of our credit cards? You know, you don't actually need that, and that's part of the risk as well. It's data minimization, and if you haven't got the information, you can't lose it, and it can't be misused. So I hope that's, you know, broadly a summary of what is a challenging, interesting, and will be a questions that are with us for many, many years. It now just falls to me to hand over for the vote of thanks. It was to have been given by Sir William Francis, who I'm sure is known to many of you, but he's, I can't give out too much personal data. He's not well at the moment and isn't able to be with us. So the vote of thanks will be given by Teresa Schofield, who I'm sure is also known to many of you, Chair of the IEEE UK, and a member of the Intellect Women in IT Forum. And Intellect is an organisation that our office has a lot of dealings with. But I think her proudest moment is to be the mother of two mechanical engineering students who are both undergraduates in different universities at the moment. And I will say, I'm sure the one from Manchester will do better than the one from Surrey. And I'll leave it at that. So thank you very much, and I hand over to Teresa.